The headline read, Billionaires Prepping for the End of the World. That was the title of an article in a recent newspaper that described the super wealthy, the people that have more money than they know what to do with. We're talking about billionaires who have apparently purchased, many of them have purchased large tracts of land in some of the most remote places on this planet, and some of the areas in which these billionaires think would be the safest place on Earth in the event of catastrophic events. Well, I saw that article several weeks ago, and then I further searched and found five similar articles all about the super uber wealthy, the billionaires of the planet, who, unfortunately for the rest of us, are already buying up all those areas that are super protected by natural defenses of mountains or just by their remote location. So for them, safety and protection. For you, not so much. It's all being gobbled up because a number of billionaires and lots of other people who are pretty wealthy as well are prepping themselves for what they think the end times might be like. Now, there doesn't seem to be any biblical theme to their search, and they're looking for places in the remote, vast areas of the earth to protect themselves from who knows what. But in a way, the great wealth that they have amassed seems to drive them to devise plans to save their own lives and to protect whatever they can of their own wealth in case apocalyptic events somehow occur. And some of the contingency plans have a great deal of detail. They put some thought into this. One Silicon Valley investor who is a billionaire has even gone to great pains to make sure that at his residence and at his work, he has a superbike, a very fast motorcycle that in the event of catastrophe, the highways would be clogged, right, with people trying to flee the city. And so he thought this out, that if he had a superbike, he could dodge around all the stalled traffic, get to the airport, get to his private jet, and be able to take off to New Zealand. It's a plan. That's what he's going to do. Many of these very, very wealthy people have built basically fortresses and forts, fortified homes that are strong enough to withstand nearby atomic blasts if necessary. They are self-sustaining. They're off the grid. They have their own air and water purification systems, their own sources of electricity, and then, of course, food stockpiles and guns and ammunition. Lots of guns and ammo. Lots and lots and various kinds, some even cannons. Lots of things to protect themselves with. A number of years ago, you may have read about Larry Ellison, who is the founder of Oracle Systems, computer software company, who bought the island of Lanai. It's a Hawaiian island. It's a huge island. He bought the entire island for $600 million. Now, reportedly, not just for a place of his own personal protection and safety. It's right across the channel from the island of Maui. It's not well habitated. There are a couple resorts, I think Four Seasons has a couple of resorts, a few golf courses. It used to be a great vast pineapple plantation, and it still is. I think he bought it in order to make it self-sustaining, grow food and everything. The climate is ideal. It's a beautiful all year round, great for farming, and I'm sure that wasn't the only reason that he bought the island was to prepare for something that might happen, but that was at least part of it. That's not a very remote area, although the Hawaiian Islands are the most remote islands on the face of the earth. They're further separated from any continent than any other place around, so it's fairly remote. He's got his own plane and jet, of course, an airport there and all of that. So good for Mr. Ellison. Good for him. Not so good for you. You can't afford to buy an island, can you? Some of you may have watched the TV series about doomsday preppers. How many of you ever seen that show? I haven't really watched it myself, but I know that it's out there. I've watched a couple of segments. I don't know what the name of it is, but it talks about people who may even be of average means, not super wealthy at all, but people who believe that the time of the end is nigh upon us. And these folks have also invested vast amounts of time and effort to find a way to protect themselves if there is a nuclear war, if there's famine, if there's plagues, if there's zombies, if there's anything like that that happens. They want to be protected. They have, you know, some of these schemes are fairly. Sorry, I had to throw that in like I was deadpanning it so I could see if there's anybody actually listening to me. But they feel in looking at the world, and again, some of them may have some biblical basis, some of them may not, but they want to be protected in case there is the unthinkable that would happen. And they also have, many of them, stores of food, enough to last. And you hear these commercials that you should have a stockpile of food that'll last you for 25 years or that has a shelf life of 25 years. And there are even some faiths, some denominations of churches that teach their members to basically store food and have stores of food and water ready to be able to protect themselves, not only in biblical consequential things, but in times in which there may be a run in the supermarkets or a natural calamity and that sort of thing. And in some groups, I don't know that it would apply to church groups necessarily, but there are these other folks that feel like they're preppers for the end of the world. They want to be ready to escape at a moment's notice, have food, and of course, guns and ammo. Lots of guns and ammo. In fact, that's true. I mean, it's a case in which they really feel like, hey, if I've got food and I'm protected and I'm safe, somebody's going to try to come get my food. They're going to know that I have food. So if they're going to get violent, then I've got to protect myself. I met one segment that I saw of these, one of these shows showed an individual that actually had several ammunition loaders. He was able to make his own ammunition, you know, from scratch and for all the different types of guns and machine guns and everything else that he has, up to 50 caliber bullets. That's a pretty big bullet, pretty big bullet. So what is your place of safety? Where is your place of safety? What is there a place of safety? Where is your refuge? Because unless you're keeping a big secret, and this applies to you in El Paso, Sierra Vista, and watching from home, unless you're keeping a big secret, I know that none of you are billionaires. We may have a billionaire watching in. I don't know. You'd have to get the password from Joe Anderson, Tree of Life, by the way, to watch it online. It's a real secret. No, all lowercase, no spacing. Next week, attendance goes down by 30%. People are, why should I go to church? I can watch this from my computer. Where is your refuge? You're not a billionaire. You're probably not a millionaire, although you could be. You can't possibly compete with the likes of the Richard Bransons of the world, who owns an island in the British Virgin Islands. Owns a whole island. It's all self-sustaining. He took our former president there, and they had a great time frolicking in the surf and the sand and the sun in the British Virgin Islands. And we've been to the British Virgin Islands. It's a beautiful spot on Earth. It's ideal. I mean, it's idyllic as well. But we didn't have enough to buy one of the islands while we were there. So we barely escaped with any money in our pockets after being there for a week. This was on a company-sponsored trip a number of years ago. What does the Bible have to say about God protecting his people? And is there a place of safety for you and your family? In July of last year, Mr. LaRavia gave a sermon on this topic entitled A Place Prepared. It was a very excellent sermon. Mr. LaRavia even showed off his skills as an amateur cartographer. I mean, somebody that makes maps, by the way. And showed us the map of the area in which the Bible shows that ancient Israel wandered around the desert for 40 years. So I fondly remember that message, and I'm not going to retrace his steps, at least very much, but the sermon was very excellent. You can listen to it on the website if you'd like to. Many years ago, and this takes some of you back to your childhood and some of you back to your young adulthood, many years ago in the Church of God, there was a great deal of interest among the brethren regarding this topic, the place of safety. But what does the Bible say about that specific topic? Zero. You were right, I heard you whisper it. It says nothing in the Bible. Nowhere in the Bible can you find a reference for the church is going to flee to a place of safety. Okay, we're done. The Bible does not say the church will flee in the time of the end. And you can't find the phrase place of safety in the Bible. So where did we come up with this common comment? Where did we come up with this phrase anyway? And what have we been taught about this topic in the past? Mr. LaRavia noted in his research that there was a great deal of work many years ago done by Dr. Herman Hay. In fact, the first article ever written about this topic, at least that I could find, that I still have notes on, was in 1958 in January, in which Dr. Hay wrote an article entitled, We Saw Petra. And there's a reason that this particular place comes up in the Bible. We're not teaching that we're all going to flee to the place called Petra in the future. But there's a reason that it came up, and you should understand those reasons so you'll understand that if the call goes out, hey, we're going to Petra, then you'll be ready and you're not going to be caught by surprise. The first article ever written on this topic appeared in January 1958 edition of The Good News. We saw Petra. Some would say Petra. We saw Petra. Petra is a place that is probably most famously recognized by more people than just church members of Worldwide Church of God back in the 50s and the 60s, because it was used in the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was a location, a filming location at that particular time where purportedly they, in the movie itself, they took the Ark of the Covenant inside Petra, if memory serves me correctly. I know it appeared there someplace, to uncover it and open it up, and then everybody got zapped with the power of God. You'll remember that. Okay. So, in this article, which was the first of several that Dr. Hay wrote, We Saw Petra, he details the wanderings, and I believe Mr. LaRavia referred to this somewhat in his message. He shows that there are various names for the same region in the Bible. In other words, Petra goes by other names other than just Petra. And the area that we call Petra today, which is located, by the way, in southern Jordan, the southern part of the nation of Jordan, goes by several names. First of all, it appears as though this is the area when ancient Israel was wandering in their first year in the wilderness. It appears as though that was the area in which the spies were sent out from the land, the 12 spies, and 10 of them came back with an evil report. Israel strove with God, and they were denied entry into the promised land from the southern route up into the land of Palestine. And I think even Mr. LaRavia may have referred to that. Mr. LaRavia, if you're listening and watching today, you can confirm that. I believe you did mention that at that particular time. Now, let's take a look at the book of Deuteronomy, which is the last book of the Pentateuch and the restatement of the law. Before Israel went into the Promised Land, Moses was inspired to recount a lot of their history of wandering through the wilderness and God's instructions and God's commands. And we find that this area, from which was a launching point for the nation of Israel to go into the Promised Land, is mentioned by a different name. And again, through the cartography skills of Mr. LaRavia, remember when he had his chart here and he showed it, that it was quite nicely done, actually, but he showed this particular area. In Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 19, it says, "So we departed from Horeb, and we went through all that great and terrible wilderness which you saw on the way to the mountains of the Amorites, as the Lord our God had commanded us. Then we came to Kadesh Barnea." Now, time does not allow me to go through point by point by point to show the proof given originally when I was in first grade, 1958, showing the, well, actually, that would be as I was still in kindergarten in January of 1958. I wouldn't go into first grade until August or September of that year. So even before I went into first grade, that research was done. Now, I'm not going to retrace the steps of Dr. Hay. You can review the article, but Kadesh Barnea is apparently the area that we call Petra, the area where there's caves and mountains and clefts in the rocks and so on and so forth. "And I said to you, you have come to the mountains of the Amorites, which the Lord our God is giving you. Look, the Lord your God has set the land before you. Go up and possess it, as the Lord God of your fathers has spoken to you. Do not fear or be discouraged." And then he talks about, he recounts what happened 39 years before and how they were at that same place, how they had been there, and they rebelled against God, and that generation died in the wilderness. Now a new generation grew up and was present, and this information is being conveyed to them to remind them, don't be like your parents. Don't be like them when they rebelled. Now's your opportunity to go in. So Moses describes that situation that happened earlier, that happened at Kadesh Barnea or Petra. Now in Joshua, we find, okay, they've entered the land. You know your Bible history, right? In the book of Joshua in chapter 10, this area under Joshua was actually given as a possession to Israel. To Israel. It doesn't belong to them anymore, but it belongs to Jordan. But God gave this very area to the Israelite tribes. In Joshua chapter 10, and we'll begin in verse 41. "And Joshua conquered them from Kadesh Barnea as far as Gaza, all the country of Goshen, even as far as Gibeon. All these kings and their land Joshua took one at a time, because the Lord God of Israel fought for Israel. Then Joshua returned and all Israel with him to the camp at Gilgal." So, again, that area was given to the nation of Israel, and in Joshua chapter 11, and beginning in verse 16, it says, "Thus Joshua took all this land, the mountain country, all the south, all the land of Goshen, the lowland, the Jordan plain, the mountains of Israel and its lowlands, from Mount Halak and the ascent to Seir, even as far as Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon below Mount Hermon. He captured all their kings and struck them down and killed them. Joshua made war a long time with all those kings." And that was that very area of Seir, as it is described here, is the area in which today, the famous tourist location, by the way, of Petra is located. It's one of those things that if you go to Jordan, probably on your itinerary, you would go south and visit Petra, this barren landscape, this particular place. Now, in Joshua chapter 15 and verse 1, it says, "So this was the lot of the tribe of the children of Judah according to their families. The border of Edom at the wilderness of Zin," which is another name for that very area in which Petra is located, "southward was the extreme southern boundary." That was the southern boundary originally when Israel was given the land. The 12 tribes went in and conquered, and that land was given to them all the way down south, included that particular area. Then it went out to the southern side of the ascent of Akaribim, passed along to Zin, ascended to the south side of Kadesh Barnea, passed along to Hezron, went up to Adar, and went around to Karka. So why did God allow Israel to take this land, to possess it, to defeat the armies of all of those Edomite kings? Why? And the answer is simple. Because in ancient times, not so much now, because you could fly over there with planes, fly over there with helicopters. Even though the Sikh, which are the walls that enter into the area called Petra, the Rose City, which was anciently inhabited by the Nabataeans or whoever, that particular area can even be accessed by tanks and motor vehicles. It's not so narrow. You can ride in on horseback, but you can drive a dump truck through that narrow opening as well. And it's seems narrow from back up, but it's fairly wide. It's wide enough to do all those things. But anciently speaking, there was a natural barrier there. This was the area in which could easily be defended. It was kind of a choke point. And God allowed this gate to Israel so that their enemies, the Edomites, natural enemies, Esau. I'm not going to answer this. Somebody's calling me, but you can't tell, can you? I thought, whose phone is buzzing? Then it's mine. So, Israel was allowed to acquire this land ostensibly so that they would have a natural defense against the Edomites, who, as you know from your Bible history, absolutely hated Israel. In fact, I think this was a special point that Mr. LaRavia made last July, that when they first went up by the highway, the King's Highway, they had to bypass Edom. The Edom wouldn't allow them passage. They were just natural enmity there from going all the way back to the days of Esau. Esau, Edom, same people, right? Esau meaning red. So what I'd like to do is at this point is just to give you a brief history of what has been written on this topic, why it became such an interesting thing, and how the church addressed this particular topic of the place of safety, even going back to the 60s, because there was so much interest. And I'll try to bring in some other citations of what happened during the 60s and the 70s regarding the teaching of the place of safety or even Petra. So I remembered that years ago I'd gotten all these articles. I don't know where they are now. They're lost in a file someplace. But one of my friends in Pasadena got me everything that had ever been written, and I've been able to find it again, and I printed them off. But this first article appeared in 1958 by Dr. Hay, and much of it was redone in a three-part series, very detailed analysis of that area of southern Jordan, along with photos. I'll leave them up here so you can look at them if you'd like to today. But the next article appeared in 1962, April Good News, of about "This is Petra" by Dr. Hay. And the subtitle, "What do Petra's mysterious ruins hold for us today? Is this hidden city the place of protection for God's church during the coming tribulation. Now, we can look back almost 50 years ago and think to ourselves, wow, the church was thinking about the great tribulation that didn't occur during the lifetime of many of those people, and that's very, very true. But unless you grew up during those times, and for those of you that are a bit younger, you would not be able, unless you had some of us old people around, to be able to understand how tumultuous those times were. A man even told me that he wasn't in the church at this particular time, but later did come into the church, that in the 1960s, with the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Cold War at full blast, and so many events happening in our world, it appeared to a lot of people that this person was the forerunner of doomsday preppers, because he and his friends got together and determined that they'd better have someplace safe to go in case it all falls apart, in case society just falls apart and the norms and the institutions aren't respected. So people becoming doomsday preppers in the 21st century is really kind of nothing new, because it was happening in the 1960s as well. People built bomb shelters. Do you all remember that craze in the 1960s? Now, nobody in my town built one, but they built one. They built, and it's really kind of a sad thing, the JCs of our community cleared a parcel of land that the city gave to them, and they created a park. And then in that park, they built a model bomb shelter. I'm not kidding. They built a bomb shelter. It was kind of underground, but it was basically made of block, and it was in the middle of a park. I think they eventually got rid of it, tore it apart or anything, because there was no threat of nuclear holocaust. But that was something that people did. So it goes back, this idea of prepping and trying to prepare for the future and protect yourself against what might come, is not only something that was on the minds of members of the church, but it was on the minds of people in society. Maybe not widespread. You know, there weren't millions of bomb shelters built during the 60s, don't get me wrong, but there were some. And there's not millions and millions of doomsday preppers in the country now, but there are some, and you may know some that are like that. The second article appeared that June in 1962, and again, it was a continuation by Dr. Hay. And we're talking really long articles, some of them 10 and 12 pages long, complete with pictures, of course. And then July, the finish-up article in July of 1962 in the Good News magazine. This concluding installment continues the history of Petra from the Old Testament and reveals the prophetic significance of Petra's past. Now, as you can imagine, during the time of the turbulent 60s and even the early 60s, we had the assassination of President Kennedy, which was certainly, for any of us that are old enough to remember that time, was one of the most significant and awful events to ever happen. And so people really wondered, and I'm sure people, I wasn't in the church, I was too young, I was 10 or 11 at the time, but with all of those events that were happening in our country, the civil unrest that was taking place, it's easy looking back to think that this idea of needing to be protected by God would gain traction, certainly among the people of the Church of God. And those of you that have been around for a long time can comment on that, perhaps, if you'd like, as long as you don't contradict me in the ministerial, in the chat session later on. In October of 1963, David John Hill wrote another article just entitled Petra! Exclamation mark. Here is an eyewitness report on Petra. The facts and the pictures you've been wanting to know and to see, but most important, an understanding of what your attitude toward a place of safety should be. Now, there are some things that as we go back in church history and we read them, may not stand the test of time, but I'm here to tell you today that these articles do. They, unless you've read them, you may not know what they guided the members to understand at that particular time. Some things don't carry well over time. By and large, these do. Norman Smith, another name from the past, wrote an article in October of 1966. We fled Petra. And he details the experience he and Dr. Rod Meredith had when they went to Amman, Jordan, and then drove down. They got a picture of them. They drove down in a Volkswagen Bug, about the same year, looks like, of my first car. But they drove down there to the area of Petra. And, you know, it's a very interesting travel log of their time and what they saw and what it was like and what their impressions were. And then the only other article written in Worldwide Church of God directly about this was an article written in the Good News magazine of May 1982 by Leroy Neff entitled, Is There a Place of Safety? And that is it. Seven in all. And you're free to look at these, and I'll show you how you can get them if you want to look at them yourself, but you're free to look at these afterwards. So that gives you a brief recitation of everything that was published officially in a major way by the Church of God way back then. So through the years, there has been an interest in Petra. Even in the topic of God's protection, we haven't necessarily emphasized it a lot. Of course, I referred back to Mr. LaRavia's sermon, which was very good, very balanced, and I really enjoyed listening to that and listening to it again just recently. But to tell you, to transport you back into time, I'm going to use Terry's experience as a little kid. Now, in this case, the instruction was probably very unbalanced, and the comment was made when speaking from the pulpit about this particular topic in the early 1960s by the minister at that time in Corpus Christi, Texas. And Corpus Christi Church was the seventh church ever established in the United States by a Worldwide Church of God. So it was an older church even at that time. There were a lot of, and when I arrived in Corpus Christi as a ministerial trainee in 1975, the attendance was about 300, about the same size as Tucson was when we got here. So there were a lot of folks, and they had been around for a long time. But the minister, when Terry was young, probably 7, 8, 9, was the injunction to obey your parents was made by the ministry and said, if you don't listen to your parents and obey them, some of you won't be going to the place of safety with your parents. And so it kind of scared them, right? It was not a pleasant thing. And, you know, threatening your kids with certain death and the Nazis coming to get you in this country is, you know, a horrifying thing for a kid. In a way, though, the minister was right, because none of those kids ever went to the place of safety. Little gallows humor. No, that's true. And that wasn't because they were disobedient. It's just because they didn't go, because it's not there yet. And through the years, the topic has waxed and waned, hasn't been emphasized so much in turn. But the proper emphasis was shown in these articles, I have to tell you. Because you can go back and you can read them and you can see that they didn't allow from a, shall we say, corporate point of view, it wasn't allowed to get out of hand and for people to, you know, do crazy stuff, although it was reported that some people actually did. I don't know if it happened, but it was reported that some, prior to 1972, maybe a couple who were either church members or affiliated with the church, decided that they would move to the area of Petra and be ready to welcome everybody else with in open arms when they arrived in 1972, because that's when they needed to be there. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know if it's actually was something that people did, or it's just one of those stories that gets told and retold so many times that it kind of takes on a life of its own and becomes reality just because people have said it. And that's not my purpose to perpetuate a myth. I'm just saying that some people said it happened. Whether it happened or not, I do not know at all. So what is said about God's protection of his people, especially in regard to the time of the end, or the end times, as we might say? Let's turn to the book of Luke, chapter 21, and verse 36. And so I will allow you, under the guidance of Bible prophecy, to come to your own conclusions on this matter, because you need to anyway. In Luke 21 and verse 36, let us ask the question, is there a place of escape? In verse 36, Christ said, "Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things." And the only things prior to this time that he mentions, the only thing that he excludes that are catastrophic in nature are zombies. No mention of zombies, so you can erase that one. It doesn't happen in the Bible, but everything else happens. Wars, famines, pestilences, earthquakes, heavenly signs. It all is mentioned previously, and Christ said, "Pray that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man." Jesus was teaching his disciples. He said in verse 24 that Jerusalem would be overrun by Gentiles, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Those times in which the Gentile nations will rise up once again, will be dominant on the world scene, not dominant now. The United States and Great Britain are still dominant on the world scene, and the world is looking anxiously to see what happens in this nation as to whether or not it will continue to police the bad behavior of the rest of the world, because that is what has been going on since World War II. That is what has been going on since America became great. It has been the police of the rest of the world to ensure safety. Now, it's not perfect, but the United States has basically held things together. So, Gentile nations are prophesied to rise again in the future, and Jerusalem is shown to be trampled by the Gentile nations at some point, just prior to Christ's return, which led to another kind of a wacky idea, and I think I told you about this last year sometime. I got the permission from my father-in-law to relay his personal example of somebody that he knows who is not in our group, but around Big Sandy, there's a lot of groups, a lot of people that used to be under the banner of Worldwide Church of God, right? You realize that. This person's idea is that you should hold an open ticket to be able to fly to Jerusalem at a moment's notice. The theory and the idea is, I don't mean to make fun of it, but I can't help myself. The idea is that you've got to have a plane ticket to get to Jerusalem, because if you're not in Jerusalem, you won't be able to escape Jerusalem. Logic, perfect sense to me. Okay, so take that for what you will. Now, there is a historical fulfillment of this particular event. In 66 AD, so 35 years after the death of Jesus Christ, there was a church. There was a church in Jerusalem. And in 66 AD, Roman armies surrounded the city of Jerusalem. But mysteriously, before they took any action, they withdrew from the city. And the historian Eusebius records that the Church of God did escape at that particular time. They left Jerusalem, and after the Romans withdrew for a period of 2 or 3 years, life went back to normal. But during that time, the church apparently left. The people of God, your historical antecedents, the people that began the early New Testament church on the day of Pentecost, and their children, their progeny, and everybody that followed after them for the next 30 years were there. But they left. And that is recorded by Eusebius, who was a historian who wrote in, a church historian who wrote in the 2nd and 3rd century. And it was backed up by another authority, which is Josephus. And he records that this is one of those things that we can't verify. It's like, remember the sermon that Mr. Tannert gave on the Festival of Lights. You know, the tradition is that during the Festival of Lights, that this small amount of oil miraculously helped the candles to stay, or the lampstand to stay lit. It's something we cannot substantiate, even as we can't substantiate who could. What Josephus records was that the church heard a sound at the temple instructing them to let us remove hence. And I don't know what the I don't know how you'd say that in the Hebrew or the Greek or whatever language they were using in Jerusalem at that particular time, but that's what Josephus records. So our historical antecedents heard a warning after the armies had withdrawn between 66 and 69 AD. They left. And in 69 AD, under the command of Vespasian, the Roman armies came back and did indeed ransack the temple, and that's when they tore the temple of God down. The Herodian temple that Christ was talking to his disciples about, recorded in Luke 21 and Matthew 24. So, in Matthew chapter 24, and in verse 16, it says, "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." Ergo, the somewhat specious logic and reasoning that you should buy a plane ticket that would get you to Jerusalem before all this happens, so then you can flee before the armies surround Jerusalem once again, as is prophesied. Sorry to have so much fun with that, but it amuses me. Verse 17, "Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house, and let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, and pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation, such as there has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved." So it will be the worst time in human history. Let's face it. It is a time that none of us really want to face. I don't want to leave my air conditioning. I don't want to go to Petra where it's hot and dry, and there's no water, and there's no food, even though there were reports years ago, I think it was David John Hill, who was kind of a funny guy himself at times, wrote about the fact that he had heard that there were vast stores of food that were being stored in the caves. And so I went into the caves. I didn't see any food being stored there. This is like 1963 or whenever he wrote the article. I didn't see any food being stored there. And all we saw were goats and Bedouins living in the caves and the goats living in the caves. And except for the goats, there wasn't any food source and it was very dry, so there was no water. So who really wants to go there? Who would want to do that on purpose unless God provided for you, right? So why has Petra become such a point, and why was it? I mean, not that that is the place of safety, but just to explain to you, some of you are newer, why it has been thought of. At least, you know, the question has come up. We'll get to that in just a bit. But Matthew 24 and verse 16, we've read that, and okay, we've moved on. And then let's go to Revelation chapter 12. Revelation 12 and verse 6, because this describes very likely another time in which the people of God have had to flee, and perhaps a future time in which they will flee. And then you see the idea, you see the reasoning behind it. It's not specious, it's not without some evidence in the Bible. There is some evidence in the Bible that these things will happen. In verse 6, it says, then the woman who is a church, shown to be the church, then the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her 1,260 days. The time period that we feel that the people of the true church of God had to flee was the time period. It's 1,260 days, use Numbers 14:34 and the day for the year principle that the Bible establishes. Remember, Israel was punished for 40 years for their 40, you know, to symbolize the 40 days, the 40 years in the wilderness, so on and so forth. So using that principle, there was a time period in which the church of God and the people of God virtually disappear from all of historical records except a few. And we think that we have found the remnants of those people in the writings and the teachings of various historical references, but why is this time period important? And it's because that in 325, when Constantine repented and became a Christian, he instituted a church of the state. And it was a powerful church, and it would become more powerful. And that church basically stamped out everything else, and there wasn't any other Christianity to be found in historical records except this church that Constantine said, and then changed the time of the Sabbath from Sabbath to Sunday, and on and on and on in 325. And the Catholic or the Roman Church was dominant. There wasn't a Protestant Reformation yet. And that didn't happen until the end of the 15th century and the 16th century. And it was only until that time when the Church of England began that there was any other Christian church. Very little mentioned about the Church of God. And the people of God were still there because why? The gates of hell shall not prevail against that church. It would never die out completely. There would be people of the faith. And that's why you and I are here today, because some of those people had to flee some of the urban centers of their day so that they could practice their faith, so that they could keep the Sabbath and very likely keep the holy days of God as the early church had done. But now they couldn't, and they had to flee. And it's thought, if you'll hold your place there, that in Revelation chapter 2, this era of the church is mentioned, and it was called the Smyrna Church Revelation chapter 2, I was in 3, sorry, in verse 8, to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these things says the first and the last who was dead and came to life. I know your works, tribulation and poverty, but you are rich, and I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Jesus Christ identifies this false church as a church of satanic origin. And this powerful church that existed at that time took on, you know what Romans says, you know, Paul says in Romans 2, what advantage then has the Jews? Much in every way, as he says in Romans 2, because to them were committed the oracles of God, the writings, the teachings. They had an advantage. Now, there is a church in history that appears to be the historical descendants, the Christian church, claiming that they're Jews, not in a literal sense, but they are the true church, but they weren't. And that's what the folks who were a part of God's church from 325 to 585 had to face. They were outcasts. And indeed, to save their lives, they did have to flee. And I'm not going to go into all the research today. I don't have time for that. But there's enough to support the claim that this is where those folks were at that particular time. So now, that is the historical aspect. But it says further on in verse 7 that after that time, after the completion of that 1260 days, at some point in the future, war broke out in heaven. It's speaking like it's a past event, but it apparently has not happened in the way that it will in the time of the end. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor is a place found in heaven for them any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, the serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast out to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So that brings up that very interesting question. Has this event already happened, or is it a future event? And we'll just leave it there, because it seems to be a future event, because what happens in verse 13, the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth. He persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. Now, that particular reference from a prophetic standpoint is backed up in several passages in the book of Daniel, that there will be a time. The greatest time of persecution that we ever went through as a group of people was perhaps the receivership crisis, which some of you aren't even old enough to remember, and some of us are, of the late 1970s. That was not the kind of persecution that will come upon the people of God in the time of the end. It says, but the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time, times and half a time, 3.5 years, from the presence of the serpent. And some of us will remember a very famous evangelist that many years ago knew that the Boeing 777s were on the drawing board, and this was apparently the way that all of us would be taken to Amman and then driven down to Jordan, I guess, southern Jordan, and go to Petra and be protected. I'm not making fun of that, but you remember that that was something that may have been said by some. So, in verse 14, 15, 16, and 17 show an coming time of tribulation, not only for the world, but specifically against the people of God, the people of the faith, the people that are us. And it's from the devil. And it mentions in verse 15, the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman. We don't know exactly what that means. That could be governmental intervention, as it has often been through the time of Constantine the Great. It was the dictates of the church were enforced by the state. By the state. Our country grew out of Great Britain initially, as we know, and immigration from all other kinds of places. But the freedom to practice religion as one wanted to was what led the Church of God to this country in the 1600s and the Seventh-day Baptists, which appear to be our historical antecedents. Practiced many of the same things. They had that name, but They apparently appear to be the initial phase of the Sardis era that, you know, still exists today, as we know, the Bible Advocate. So moving forward, the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, or the church, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So it does appear, doesn't it, that some are protected, some not. Some are protected, some not. Some go through a time period of persecution. Now in Daniel 11 and verse 40, when does all of this happen? If it does, Daniel 11 and in verse 40 and verse 41, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land. Remember, armies surround Jerusalem. It's happened historically, anciently. It definitely is going to happen again. The king of the north will surround. And Christ warned about that. When you see armies surrounding Jerusalem, that is the abomination that makes desolate. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Those are the areas that get away scot-free. And so why has Petra, Kadesh Barnea, why have those things come up in our teachings? Because of the logical extension that if these are the areas that are not oppressed by the beast power, the king of the north, and that appears to be an area that has been prominent in the history of ancient Israel, and that it has been done in that way, then perhaps that is the reason that it has been such a, has played such a prominent part in our writings and our history going back low these many years. Now in Daniel chapter 8, but apart from that, basically, we don't have any guarantees. We don't have any thus saith the Lord's on Petra or any other place for that matter. But the issue is, will God's people be protected? And that seems to be one that we can easily answer. In the latter time, this is Daniel 8 and verse 23, in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise having fierce features who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. That shows the ability of man to oppress other men. And we know from the other scriptures putting together that that power and authority comes from a devilish source. Now, Psalm 121 was a hymn that it was in our older hymnal, and I was looking for it the other day. It's not in this new hymnal. You'll remember the psalm that we used to sing in our old hymnals. It's not here, but I'm sure you can remember it by heart. And it was written in a weird time, 2-3 or something like that. So as a song leader, it was always hard to lead because you couldn't go 1-2-3, 1-2-3. You'd look silly doing this, so you had to lead it with long strokes. To the hills I'll lift mine eyes, from whence shall come my help? All my help comes from the Lord, who created heaven and earth, or something like that. Okay. He shall e'er be thy guide, and thy foot shall never... Yeah, you got it right and wrong, right? Because they changed the words from slide to slip or slip to slide at one point in one of the remakes. So you know that song. In the new hymnal, we have that extract from Psalm 121, We have number 75. This was written by Mark Graham. And unto the hills I lift my eyes. I don't know if we've sung this one in a while or if ever. Oh, whence shall come my aid? So the wording is very similar, but it's from one Psalm 121. Then we also have Psalm 143, which is kind of a written by somebody that I went to college with, Sonia King. And it's kind of a got of a Hebrew type of it's be not afraid, my people. So it's, but it basically talks about what Psalm 121 talks about. And if you want to take your survey, then you could say, hey, let's have that old 121 back in the hymnal next time we reprint it. So in Psalm 121, which we sang a lot, and it was such a beautiful, I think it was beautiful, despite the fact that I sang it just now. I still think the melody is beautiful, and I hope that you do, even though I was singing it a cappella. Which when one time on the Andy Griffith Show, when Barney was asked if he knew how to sing a cappella, he said, yeah, I know how to sing a cappella. A cappella, a cappella, a cappella. Do you remember that one? So in Psalm 121, I will lift up my eyes to the hills, from whence comes my help. My help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. He will not allow your foot to be moved, the foot to slip, slide. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he keeps Israel. He who keeps Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord shall preserve you from all evil. He shall preserve your soul. The Lord shall preserve your going out and your coming in from this time forth and even forevermore. That is a promise that God makes to his people, that they will be protected, and that you can look to that at difficult times in your life, and you can see that we can have God's favor. So not too much longer now, just a little bit more further proof so that I want you, I'm not dogmatically teaching this, hey, we're all going to a place of safety in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. Not doing that. I want you to understand what your church has taught in the past and why. And why it does have some logic to it, and why it's at least an interesting consideration. We're going back into the yesteryear of our history, and even if you weren't a part of it then, you should experience a little bit of it now and understand it and take a look at these articles, and you'll see that the balance is given even during that time. You know, hey, don't get your sights set on going to Petra to escape, because Christ said that he who seeks to save his life shall lose it. But in Isaiah 16 and verse 1, we read, send the lamb to the ruler of the land, from Selah to the wilderness. Another terminology, by the way, for the area of Petra. To the mount of the daughter of Zion. For it shall be as a wandering bird thrown out of the nest. So shall the daughters of Moab at the fords of Arnon. That's the area we're talking about. Take counsel, execute judgment, make your shadow like the night in the middle of the day. Hide the outcasts. Do not betray him who escapes. Let my outcasts dwell with you, O Moab. Where did Moab go? Where was the land of Moab? The Bible says, I think it's Jeremiah, that these people settled on their lees. They didn't leave. Moab anciently is Moab today, and that is where the Bible says that the outcasts should be protected. So is it a possibility? It is. Is it dogmatically stated by Steve Buchanan? No, but I'm just reading to you what the Bible says. Be a shelter to them from the face of the spoiler, for the extortioner is at an end. Devastation ceases. The oppressors are consumed out of the land. In mercy, the throne will be established, and one will sit on it in truth, the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judging, justice and hastening righteousness. So this is a prophecy of Isaiah that does seem indeed to point to the time of the end. Psalm 91 is another promise of God's protection during the time of great calamity, and I think that we can easily see its application to the time of the end. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High, where's that? Shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress. My God, in Him I will trust. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler, and from the perilous pestilence He shall cover you with His feathers. And under His wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side, and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes you shall look and see the reward of the wicked. Because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place, no evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near your dwelling. He shall give His angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways. In their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. This was the scripture that, of course, Satan quoted to Jesus Christ when he offered Him up all the kingdoms of the world, right? You shall tread upon the lion and the cobra, the young lion and the serpent you shall trample underfoot. Because He has set His love upon me, therefore I will deliver him. I will set him on high because he has known my name. He shall call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him, and with long life I will satisfy and show him my salvation. Your only way of escape is not with your own guns and ammo, not with your 25-year supply of food, not with your water stores, if you have them, not by any other means except by God's divine intervention and protection in your life. And this is backed up by Psalm 62 and Psalm 18. So the church, years ago, was very balanced in teaching these principles to the people of God, that they shouldn't look upon a place, a location, as the salvation of God, or the ability to get there at a moment's notice as the salvation. The church taught the members from its publications, now from anecdotal evidence from the pulpit sometimes got a little unbalanced, but that aside, the church's basic teaching on this topic has always been very balanced, and I have the proof to show you as well. Will a place of safety be provided for the people of God? Will that place of safety be in southern Jordan? The answer is really indefinite. However, the real necessity for God's people is to be spiritually awake, and that is very clear. I can certify to you that the billionaires of this earth will not be successful in spending their vast wealth to create their own sanctuaries or places of safety, though. That cannot be done. Only God can protect you from what will happen in the time of the end.